Now a look at climate change and new and different ways to deal with it. We hear constantly about cutting emissions caused by carbon pollution, and there's no doubt we have to do that. But what are the other solutions? What about using aerosols to protect the ozone layer? Now that does sound crazy. Well, one Harvard researcher and leader in the world of geoengineering believes sulfate aerosols could be used to create something of a protective barrier in the atmosphere. Environmental scientist David Keith from Harvard University has some radical proposals, some true counterpoints on climate change and how to fix it. And he joins us now from the United States. David Keith, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Now, look, I'm not a scientist, but I'm fascinated by science. I almost have a regret that I didn't do science at school and at university. So what is the essence, the nub of your idea?
I love that little almost. The essence of the idea, and by the way, it's not my idea. It's a really old idea dating back to the 1960s. The essence is that humanity might deliberately make the Earth a little more reflective, say by adding some aerosols, some little tiny scattering particles to the upper atmosphere, in a way that would reduce some of the risks of climate change. It doesn't get us out of the need to cut CO2 emissions. We have to do that. But it could take the edge off and make things a little less bad.
Right. Now, how would we do that? We're not obviously going to send thousands of people up with gas tanks on their back spraying stuff around. We're presumably going to use aircraft. What kind of technology is involved?
Yeah, technically it's surprisingly easy. So it seems like with sort of more or less technology you could get off the shelf from commercial aircraft manufacturers today, you could get aircraft that would go up into the lower stratosphere in the tropics and put in this material, whatever it is. There's lots of ideas. Calcium carbonate, for example, which is basically chalk or limestone aerosol is one idea. Be fine powder that would basically go up. And the amount would be something like a million tons a year, very round numbers.
Million tons a year, gee. Now, do you think there's a bit of a moral hazard here? I used to, in the previous life, be in Parliament and had responsibility at some point for welfare. And there's always an argument about welfare, about whether there's a moral hazard. As soon as you offer a safety net or increase the safety net, the argument is you encourage people to think, well, okay, I can slip back into that. Would using something like this, if it worked, discourage people from finding ways to reduce their emissions and other ways to improve the world's climate?
I think there's absolutely some moral hazard here. And the concern, just as you said, is that people will think this is some kind of get out of jail free card, and that maybe, say, the big oil industry or coal companies will use it as a way to say, those Harvard guys have got this all solved, we don't need to cut emissions. And that's complete nonsense. The fact is, you have to cut emissions if you want a stable climate. This is just something to reduce the damage while we do that. So I think it is a risk, but it's by no means a certainty. There are lots of reasons to think it actually could go the other way. So it's a complicated story about moral hazard, but no question it's a concern.
Mm. Now, you're going to have some sort of trial early next year over Tucson in Arizona, is that right?
Yeah, definitely not a trial. To me,
a trial
is something you do. Yeah, a trial is something you do if you have a pretty well-tested technology and you've, ready to actually use it and you want to test out whether it works. That is absolutely not what we're doing. This is, in a sense, really in the mainstream of the way atmospheric geoscience works, where we're doing experiments. These experiments are of tiny scale. They're not intended to manipulate the climate. They're intended to test some of the key interactions of, say, these calcium carbonate aerosols in the stratosphere. And so in that way, it's like lots of other atmospheric science experiments that release small amounts of material. They're not trying to change the climate. They're trying to understand something to help us improve the models that will assess how risky or how beneficial these things might be.
Mm.
I mean, maybe it helps to say the amount of material we would release in this experiment, this is called, has a fancy name, stratospheric controlled perturbation experiment. The amount of material we'd release would be something like 100 grams. So that's less than, a small amount of dust. It's less than the amount of sulfuric acid that a regular aircraft that you would fly in as a tourist emits in 1 minute of flight because there's sulfur mixed into the jet fuel.
Hmm, gee. Now, one of the things I read that made me happy, when you get to my age, a lot of things can make you mad and a lot of things can make you happy. And one of the things that makes you happy is when you learn that someone's looking for what could go wrong. And I read, and I hope this is true, that a lot of the Harvard program money going into this is going to look at what could go wrong and to challenge the ethics and practicality of it all. In other words, you're not leading a team of people who are evangelical, if you like, that they're certain they're right. You're leading a team that wants to actually step back and look broadly at the problem and look for where you might be wrong. And if that's right, hooray to you.
Yeah, thank you for picking up on that. I mean, I think this is a thing where anybody who thinks they have the full answer is
nuts.
It's full of nuts. It's bollocks. and I think you the whole idea here is my goal personally is that we need a larger kind of international open access research effort to understand the goods and the bads of this. And I think it's really important that it not be a single integrated effort, because you need some folks who are pushing ahead trying to figure out how it might actually work. But actually need more effort trying to think of all the ways it wouldn't work, and especially all the ways we might govern it. This is a really complicated thing. I think the important thing is we bring it out of the dark ages. For years, there's been a taboo about talking about this, and that means people just kind of whisper, and they don't get serious about thinking about both how well it might work and how it might really fail. And I think we need to just start getting serious about understanding it.
Mm. I also read that perhaps people think about this, worry about geoengineering in the context of climate change, but you asked them to go back and imagine, what if we'd never used fossil fuels? Just imagine somehow we found some other way. You know, we got onto solar and wind and all that very early, and everything was hunky-dory. And then for some inexplicable reason, there was a big natural seep of heat-trapping gas from within the Earth that would have the same consequences of the CO2 emissions. Then we might look at this geoengineering as being a great saviour, and I'm very happy to jump forward with it. Do you think that part of the reason some people are apprehensive about this is because it relates to man-made climate change?
Well, I mean, it's all about man-made climate change, but the point of that example is it sort of pokes at the core moral issue, the issue about kind of intentionality and about guilt. So if it's true these technologies can really reduce risk, you know, there are actually people who are going to die, will die, are dying from extreme heat waves and from climate-induced damages. And so we really do have some duty to try and reduce their risk. And the point there is to say, if there was a natural CO2 seep, and that fact that's happened before, there were natural CO2 seeps, say, 55 million years ago that made this thing called the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, a time where it was extraordinarily warm and a lot of the things were destroyed. Those weren't obviously to do with humans. That was a natural leak. But if there was some leak of CO2 like that, you would think about the risks and benefits of this technology quite differently. It would still have risks, but you wouldn't have this big kind of moral burden that it's like patching this thing that we've done. And it is patching this thing that we've done. The only reason we're talking about this is because we put the CO2 in the air. Mm. But the thing that people forget is we can't magically take the CO2 out of the air in a second. So, I mean, again, the thing that people forget is there's no way for us to just wish our way out of the problem. Even if we cut CO2 emissions to zero tomorrow, which we can't do. I mean, realistically, we could do it in 30 years working hard, and we will. But even if we cut CO2 emissions to zero, it doesn't make the problem go away. It just stops the problem getting worse.
Yeah.
Because the climate problem is to do with the accumulation of CO2 emissions over all industrial history. And so it's not that this is an alternative to cutting emissions. It's what we do about the risk from the CO2 that's already in the air.
So what kind of risk is that someone, once you get it going, can decide we're going to turn it off, and that brings a sudden and abrupt change with which we are unable to cope?
That's a great question. And the funny thing is it's kind of a flip side of another risk, and the two oppose each other. So one of the big political concerns with this is because it's so damn cheap that in principle almost any country could do it, which is scary. It allows unilateral action, and I think that's a genuine risk. But the flip side of that is that the actual risk of this so-called termination, that one country that was doing it would suddenly turn it off, after it had been built up over years, I think that risk is actually pretty low, because other countries, even if they actually didn't want it done, would have an enormous self-interest to maintain the ability to do it in case that entity that was doing it switched it off. And because it's cheap, it'd be actually quite cheap for many nations to maintain the ability to do it to start up in a couple of years, which is what you need. So I think the idea that it would suddenly turn off without a consensus to do that is actually pretty low risk, precisely because of this other risk that it can be done unilaterally.
Mm. One of the things that can help with climate change in an odd kind of way, as I understand it, is volcanic eruptions. The example of Mount Pinatubo in 1991 is one that comes to mind. Now, if that's right, and it's in a sense similar to that, that raises other concerns because, you know, while it might have a climatic effect, an eruption from a volcano, it has other pretty disastrous effects too. Do they equate in that way or not at all?
No, there's some ways in which they're absolutely similar. So both, in the end, act on the climate by putting these fine aerosols in the stratosphere. But a volcano does this in this huge explosive way, putting it all in one big lump, which has huge local consequences and has the risk of all that volcanic ash, which both can be just deadly to the people nearby and can disrupt aviation and so on. That, in that sense, it's completely different because you'd be putting the materials up there in a very different way with, you know, a small fleet like of sort of 50 or 100 aircraft that would be continuously putting the material up there. So that risk would be very different.
Even and fine distribution.
Yeah. I think the key distinction is the thing that you see in a volcano, this huge cloud of ash, and it's that ash that falls back to Earth and kills people on the ground or damages or can destroy airplanes. That ash is not the thing that changes the climate. The thing that changes the climate for volcanoes is actually invisible sulfur dioxide that gets carried right up to the stratosphere. And the thing that might be done for solar geoengineering, this idea of modifying the climate this way, would be to deliberately put just pure sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere. But indeed, we're actually thinking about other things other than sulfur dioxide that would be less risky.
You see, that's the benefit you have, Professor, of being a scientist. You understand all this stuff. The rest of us who read about volcanoes making a difference and then we hear you're going to make a difference and we think, well, are they the same? And we're lucky to have someone like you who can explain it to someone like me and others what's going on here. I, for one, have to say I don't have any concern about the ethics of this in the sense of messing with nature. We do that by our existence on the planet. From my point of view, all strength to your arm. I hope it goes well. I hope your experiments go well. And congratulations, because you've been on this for decades and people have been sceptical and you're finally getting somewhere. So that shows the rewards of persistence. Thanks very much for joining us today on Counterpoint.
Well, thank you so much. It was really terrific. And just to end on the note that I think we're doing research, but we do not make decisions about what happens. And those decisions are ones that every citizen owns equally about what on earth we do to steer this planet.
Sure, indeed. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
We are a rock revolving around the golden sun. We are a billion children.